Star right here on Radio Catskill.
This is live special coverage from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. In a few minutes, the Supreme Court will hear arguments on birthright citizenship. The major question, does the Constitution automatically grant citizenship to all babies born in the United States? The answer has long been yes, and considered settled law, until now. On his first day back in the White House, President Trump issued an executive order limiting citizenship for babies born in the U.S. to parents who weren't in the U.S. legally or permanently. Federal courts have rejected the order. Trump appealed to the Supreme Court, and he says he's going to watch the proceedings today. A motorcade just arrived at the court moments ago. Joining us now to better understand today's arguments and what's at stake, we have Supreme Court correspondent Carrie Johnson and senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi to you both.
Hey there.
Hi.
So, Carrie, I want to start with you. President Trump says he's actually going to be in the courtroom for these arguments, which seems a little unusual to me. What do you make of this?
It is unusual. I couldn't find any evidence that a sitting president had ever done this before. Although Trump has been at the Supreme Court, he went for the swearing in of one of his picks in his first term, Neil Gorsuch. He has talked about wanting to go to previous Supreme Court arguments, like in his major tariffs case, but he never got to the court for that one. This seems to be different and a signal of how important this issue is to him and his agenda.
Well, as I mentioned, his executive order ending birthright citizenship is center stage today. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that order actually said?
Yeah, on his very first day back in the White House, President Trump issued an executive order that he said was designed to protect the meaning and value of American citizenship. He basically restricted the idea, the long practice of birthright citizenship, which said babies born in the United States automatically become citizens. In the president's view, and his executive order explicitly states that babies born to people in the country illegally or here only temporarily, like on work visas or student visas, would not get the benefit of American citizenship. And that really stands in the face of over a century of American law and precedent.
Well, and to your point, I guess, lower courts have found this order to be illegal. Why?
Yeah, no judge who has considered this issue has sided with the president, at least not yet. And that's in part because the text of the 14th Amendment says that all persons born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are American citizens. The Trump administration is quibbling with that phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, although it's been interpreted by a prior Supreme Court in the 1890s and blessed by Congress twice in 1940 and 1952. So were the Supreme Court to side with the Trump administration, it would really counteract what previous courts have said, Congresses have said, and basically the understanding of the law for more than a century.
Domenico, when President Trump talks about this, he often says that the United States is the only country that has birthright citizenship. Is that true?
Well, it's not the only country, but there are not that many countries that actually do it. I mean, there are about three dozen countries that have automatic citizenship for anyone born in the United States, mostly in the Western Hemisphere. This used to be a practice that actually took place in more places. Africa, for example, had it during a lot of colonization. That's why a lot of South America has it as well, because you had people who were moving to those countries and wanting to outnumber the populations of those countries. So very different reason for why that's happening today. And we've seen some restrictions actually take place in Europe. For example, in 2005, Ireland overturned their practice of jus soli, as it's known, to grant automatic citizenship when 80% of the citizenship, or roughly thereof, said that they didn't want it anymore. We saw Italy, for example, earlier last month in March, saying that they restricted further the bloodline that you could claim to be able to get citizenship in their country as well. And we've seen this happen with the rise of a lot of right wing immigration, anti-immigration rhetoric, and also, frankly, the ease of travel to other places and other countries. In this country, we've heard President Trump and a lot of conservatives talk about birth tourism, for example, which happens in some cases. It's not a widespread practice. And a lot of this, though, I mean, when it comes down to it, like we're talking about with immigration, has to do with the politics around immigration. It's really the thing that President Trump has animated him and his base for a long time in the midst of demographic change that's happening in this country, where whites in this country are moving quickly toward becoming the minority in America.
Well, yeah, immigration is obviously a very polarizing issue in American politics. How do people actually feel? Do we know anything about how people actually feel about this idea of birthright citizenship?
Well, the polling on this is pretty nuanced and kind of complicated and depends on how the question is asked. And that's true with a lot of polling, but it's particularly the case in for birthright citizenship, as I found. For the most part, people in general are in favor of continuing the practice, but much more overwhelmingly for babies who are born to citizens. They're split, really, or have even worse support for babies who are born to people who are in the country illegally or only temporarily. A lot of that breaks down by party in ways that we've seen previously.
All right, I'm gonna have to cut you off there, Domenico. Arguments are about to start.
Citizenship to the newly freed slaves and their children, whose allegiance to the United States had been established by generations of domicile here. It did not grant citizenship to the children of temporary visitors or illegal aliens who have no such allegiance. This conclusion reflects the original public meaning of the clause. When Congress used the term not subject to any foreign power in the Civil Rights Act of 1866, it rejected the British conception of allegiance. Senator Trumbull explained that subject to the jurisdiction thereof in the clause means not
this
only
is U.S. Solicitor General John Sauer talking.
In 1884, this court recognized that subject to the jurisdiction means owing direct and immediate allegiance. The clause thus does not extend citizenship to the children of temporary visa holders or illegal aliens. Unlike the newly freed slaves, those visitors lack direct and immediate allegiance to the United States. For aliens, lawful domicile is the status that creates the requisite allegiance, and the text of the clause presupposes domicile. For decades following the clause's adoption, commentators recognized that the children of temporary visitors are not citizens, and illegal aliens lack the legal capacity to establish domicile here. Unrestricted birthright citizenship contradicts the practice of the overwhelming majority of modern nations. It demeans the priceless and profound gift of American citizenship. It operates as a powerful pull factor for illegal immigration and rewards illegal aliens who not only violate the immigration laws, but also jump in front of those who follow the rules. It has spawned a sprawling industry of birth tourism as uncounted thousands of foreigners from potentially hostile nations have flocked to give birth in the United States in recent decades, creating a whole generation of American citizens abroad with no meaningful ties to the United States. I welcome the court's questions.
General Sauer, before we get into the broader national issues, would you start with Dred Scott? Dred Scott was a
this is Justice
case about
Clarence
state
Thomas
citizenship.
Talking.
It was a diversity case. We know what Chief Justice Taney did with that. How does the Citizenship Clause respond specifically to Dred Scott and answers or changes or corrects its answer as to citizenship? The other point is the Citizenship Clause refers not just to national citizenship, but also to state citizenship. Are we to have two different definitions for those? It's one word, citizens of the United States and citizens of the state wherein they reside. So, as you begin, I'd like you to go back at the beginning and be more specific about the answer, and I want you to explain whether or not those two definitions are the same or related, and what state citizenship is based on.
Thank you, Justice Thomas. I'll maybe start by addressing Dred Scott. As you alluded to the fact, Dred Scott, impose one of the worst injustices in the history of this court, and it led to the outbreak of the Civil War. It's very clear, and this court in all of its early cases interpreting the 14th Amendment said, you know, the one pervading purpose, the main object of the Citizenship Clause is to overrule Dred Scott and establish the citizenship of the freed slaves. And if you look at the debates in the congressional record and discussion surrounding the adoption of the Citizenship Clause, what you see is a very clear understanding that the newly freed slaves and their children have a relationship of domicile. They do not have a relationship to any foreign power. For example, there's a comment where he says, look, people have been here for five generations and clearly have no relationships to any foreign African potentate, or have a relationship of allegiance to the United States. And that reinforces our point that allegiance is what the word jurisdiction means. It doesn't mean regulatory jurisdiction or sort of being subject, merely subject to the laws. They're talking and they're thinking about it in those debates about allegiance. Now, as to your second question, if you look at the text of the clause, we believe there it says, born in the United States, born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, are citizens of the United States and the states of which they reside. So there's a constitutional guarantee that applies to both federal or national and state citizenship. And the key point we make there is that that word reside, if you look at, for example, section 1473 of Justice Story's commentaries, was understood to mean domicile. So when they say subject to the jurisdiction, and then they go on to say you're a citizen of the United States and the state in which they reside, the very text of the clause itself presupposes that the citizen is domiciled in the United States. If they're present in a state at all, they reside there. Reside means domicile in the Constitution, and we think that strongly supports our interpretation. It's textual evidence of our domicile-based theory of jurisdiction.
Well, starting with that theory, you obviously put a lot of weight on subject to the jurisdiction thereof. But the examples you give to support that strike me as very quirky.
That's John Roberts
children,
talking, Chief
of
Justice.
Ambassadors, children of enemies during a hostile invasion, children on warships. And then you expand it to a whole class of illegal aliens are here in the country. I'm not quite sure how you can get to that big group from such tiny and sort of idiosyncratic examples.
There are those sort of narrow exceptions for ambassador foreign public ships. Tribal Indians is an enormous one that they were very focused on in the debates as well. But what I do is I invite the court to look at the intervening step, which is the enactment of the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And there they didn't say subject to the jurisdiction thereof. There it says not subject to any foreign power. Now, if you go back to Blackstone and Calvin's case, they say it does not matter if you are subject to any foreign power. If you are born in the king's domains, you have this indefeasible duty of allegiance to the king at any time. So there's a clear repudiation in the Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act is this breakwater which makes it very, very clear that they are not thinking about allegiance in the terms of like the British common law. They've adopted the Republican conception of allegiance. So it's from not subject to any foreign power, and then the debates just a couple months later make it very clear that they're recodifying the same conception. They were dissatisfied with the potential ambiguity in the phrase Indians not taxed, and they adopted subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And one of the strongest statements of this is Senator Trumbull's statement that I quoted at the beginning, where he's asked, what does that mean, subject to the jurisdiction thereof? And he says, it means not owing allegiance to anybody else. That is what it means. And this court picked up on that in Elk against Wilkins when it says, it uses, completely subject to the political jurisdiction, not merely regulatory jurisdiction.
What do you do with one Kim Ark's quote of Daniel Webster, who said, independently of
Sonia Sotomayor,
with intention to continue such residence, independently of any domiciliation, independently of the taking of any oath of allegiance or renouncing any former allegiance, it is well known that by the public law, a non-citizen, while he is here in the United States, owes obedience to this country's laws. Now, the examples that Wong Ark Kim used as exceptions are situations in which there was not temporary allegiance to the United States. The children of foreign diplomats whose only allegiance was to their foreign country, and or occupied territory residents, including those citizens in Maine who had been occupied by the British forces. The U.S. had no control over them. And the whole theory of the Indian tribes was similar. The Indian tribes were analogized to foreign diplomats. So what do we do with that?
I'd say two things. First, as the Indian tribes, we think that's a case that strongly supports us because, of course, by 1866 and 1868, there was strong understanding that the Indian tribes were subject to the United States' regulatory jurisdiction.
But not the same way that temporary foreigners were, meaning there was a real debate going on whether the U.S. actually had jurisdiction over Indian tribes. That's why our cases, for the longest time, until that was finally settled, said, absent some act of Congress, our laws don't apply, U.S. laws don't apply to Indians on Indian lands, correct?
I believe you look at the Rogers decision, for example, that we cite in our brief, where they say that they are subject to the
United States. That's later. I'm talking at the time.
Yes, at the time. So as to 1817.
So what do you do during the debates of the 1866 Civil Rights Act and of the 14th Amendment with the entire discussion of the people who opposed the amendment, who kept saying, we can't pass it because we're making citizens of gypsies who have no allegiance to anybody, and we're going to make citizens of Chinese people who can't be citizens because we're not going to permit them to be citizens. What do we do with those debates and the fact that the proponents of both acts said everyone who's born in the U.S. will be citizens?
First, as to that particular exchange, page 2890 of the Congressional Record from 1866, Senator Cowan gives this virulently racist statement where he says that. And what does he say right at the beginning of that sort of offensive speech? He says, we can't have children of gypsies, children of Chinese immigrants. We can't have them become citizens. And he says, quote, have they any more rights than a sojourner in the United States? So he's trying to persuade the Republicans to his view by appealing to a common understanding that sojourners do not have children who become citizens. There's powerful evidence there that everybody understood this to, you know, not sweep in the temporary sojourner. And that's why you see for 40, 50 years, you see every commentator who addresses the specific question of temporary presence saying it's not covered by the clause, including for decades after Wong Kim Ark.
General, can I take you back to the Chief Justice's question about the specific exceptions to birthright citizenship that everybody seems to agree were recognized under the common law? And it brings up
an important Samuel
principle
Alito
about how we interpret the law. When particular problems pop up, lawmakers may enact a general rule. When they do that, is the application of that general rule limited only to the situations that they had in mind when they adopted the general rule? Or do we say they adopted a general rule, they meant for that to apply to later applications that might come up? Justice Scalia had an example that dealt with this situation. He imagined an old theft statute that was enacted well before anybody conceived of a microwave oven, and then afterwards someone is charged with the crime of stealing a microwave oven, and this fellow says, well, I can't be convicted under this because the microwave oven didn't exist at that time. And he dismissed that. There's a general rule there, and you apply it to future applications. And what we're dealing with here is something that was basically unknown at the time when the 14th Amendment was adopted, which is illegal immigration. So how do we deal with that situation when we have a general rule?
Yeah, I strongly agree with the way that you framed it, that there is a general principle that's a broad principle that's adopted in the phrase subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And we submit that our theory of allegiance and domicile-based allegiance is what explains those specific exceptions that everybody was aware of. But it is broad enough to sweep in future situations. And as you pointed out, illegal immigration did not exist then. Now, the problem of temporary visitors did exist. And it's very interesting that as you look at pages 26 and 28 of our brief, commentators going from, you know, 1881 until 1922 are uniformly saying the children of temporary visitors are not included. Now, that logic, we say, it naturally extends. It's really an a fortiori case. If you have someone who enters illegally by the 1880s, there are restrictions on immigration. If you've entered illegally, it's kind of, you know, a well-established principle of law going back to the Code of Justinian that says you're not allowed to be there. You don't have the legal capacity to create domicile there.
But I think, General Sauer, that what you just said suggests that you can't be arguing in the way Justice Alito suggests, because most of your brief is not about
illegal
aliens. Most of your brief is about people who are just temporarily in the country, where there was quite clearly an experience of, an understanding of, that there were going to be temporary inhabitants. And your whole theory of the case is built on that group. You don't get to talking about undocumented persons until quite later and at much lesser, you know, I think it's like 10 pages to 3 pages or something like that. So you can't really be going with Justice Alito's theory. You must be saying that there is a principle that developed, that was there in at the time of the 14th Amendment. Isn't that right?
We agree there's a principle there at the 14th Amendment. It is the jurisdiction means allegiance, the allegiance of a, and this very strongly reflected in the 19th century sources, the allegiance of an alien president in another country is determined by domicile. And that goes back to the Venus and the Pizarro. It goes through the Katza affair in 1853. It comes right up to Fong Yui Ting and Lau Ao Bu that are decided shortly before Wong Kim Ark. So that's the principle. That principle clearly applies here. I also respectfully disagree.
Yeah,
with
and
that.
I guess, I think, Mr. General Sauer, where does this principle come from? Allegiance, domicile. Allegiance, I think you point to a Lincoln funeral speech as your primary example of where this principle comes from. It's certainly not what we think of when we think of the word jurisdiction, and I appreciate that jurisdiction has many meanings, but, you know, the first meaning is like if you're subject to jurisdiction, you're subject to the authority of. One doesn't say, oh, what that means is a certain kind of allegiance that domiciliaries have and nobody else does. So the text of the clause, I think, does not support you. I think you're sort of looking for some more technical, esoteric meaning. And then the question comes, okay, if the text doesn't support you, if there's a real history of people using it that way, but as far as I can tell, you know, at the time of the 14th, you're using some pretty obscure sources to get to this concept.
Well, I take it straight from the framers' mouths. So, for example, Senator Trumbull was asked, what does jurisdiction mean? He means subject to the jurisdiction. He said, what does that mean? He says it means not owing allegiance to anybody else. He is the principal framer of the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Representative Bingham, who's the framer of the 14th Amendment, is asked, what does it mean in the Congressional Record at page 1291? He says, within the jurisdiction of the United States of parents not owing allegiance to any foreign sovereignty. And we've cited many, many examples where the congressional debates reflect that. Then you referred to the oration of George Bancroft. That's one of probably 16 sources, but there's at least 13, counting that one in the 12 treaties as we cited pages 26 to 28 of our brief. There is over a dozen sources that specifically address temporary sojourners. In the 5 decades after the enactment of the amendment, every single one of them says, well, temporary sojourners, their children are not included, including for 2 decades after Wong Kim Ark.
So if domicile's the key linchpin to your argument, and I take it that it is, do we look at how domicile was understood in 1868, or do we look at it how it's understood today in context?
That's Justice Neil Gorsuch talking.
The 1868 understanding, I'm not aware of a strong difference between those.
Well, here's where I'm going with it. I'm just working within your argument for a moment. Today, you can point to laws against immigration that are much more restrictive than they were in 1868. We really didn't have laws like that that we do today until maybe 1880. So if somebody showed up here in 1868 and established domicile, that was perfectly fine without respect to anything, any immigration laws. There they were. And so why wouldn't we, even if we were to apply your own test, come to the conclusion that the fact that someone might be illegal is immaterial?
I would first cite Wong Kim Ark on that point, because Wong Kim Ark says you're...
Well, I'm not sure how much you want to rely on Wong Kim Ark.
But there is a statement in there that says, so long as they are permitted to be here. So Wong Kim Ark, keep in mind that by the time they decide Wong Kim Ark in 1898...
But that's 1898. Now I'm looking at 1868, you're telling me, is when I should look, and the test for domicile. And the stuff you have about unlawfully present, it's like Roman law sources you're going to.
First and second restatements as well, and decisions of this court.
So it wouldn't be the INA that would control whether you're capable of having domicile. It would be whatever the law was in 1868.
I think that this is addressed by my exchange with Justice Alito from earlier, which is that this concept, jurisdiction, allegiance and domicile,
so Congress
is applied
could continually restrict who may lawfully be present more and more, and you'd say that would be incorporated into it, even though you're telling us to apply the original meaning of 1868.
The original meaning of domicile. And so the question is there any argument that the framers intended to preclude Congress from dictating who can and who cannot establish a lawful domicile here? I don't see any evidence of that in the congressional record, so it's a natural extension.
Whose domicile matters? I mean, it's not the child, obviously. It's the parents you'd have us focus on. And, you know, what if, is it the husband? Is it the wife? What if they're unmarried? Whose domicile?
Well, in the executive order, it draws a distinction between the mother and the father. It's really the mother's domicile. I think that would matter.
Well, but 1868 matters, you're telling us. So what's the answer?
The 1868 sources talk about parental. I'm not aware of them drawing a distinction between mother or father, but they say the domicile of the child follows the domicile of the parents.
And how are we going to determine domicile? I mean, would we use contemporary sources on what qualifies as domicile in a state, or do we look in 1868? And do we have to do this for every single person?
And again, I don't see a strong distinction between those because, of course, domicile is a high-level concept, has been pretty consistent over centuries, which is lawful presence with the intent to remain permanently. That domicile, when you've come to a new nation, you say, I'm here to stay, you become part of their political community, and you become akin to a citizen. And that's reflected very strongly in the case I cited before.
And just to circle back to Justice Kagan's point, it's striking that in none of the debates do we have parents discussed. We have the child's citizenship and the focus of the clause is on the child, not on the parents. And you don't see domicile mentioned in the debates. The absence is striking.
I think the 19th century sources would say a newborn child lacks the capacity to form a domicile, so they're imputed the domicile of their parents. So I don't think they would have seen a distinction between children and parents. And I point out that their position, like ours, is forced to look at the domicile of the parents because we look at the exceptions that they accept, like
I'm talking about tribal Indians and so forth. I'm talking about in the debates over the 14th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act. It's striking that these concepts aren't discussed in them.
I think domicile is discussed. I mean, it's brought up in many...
Allegiance, jurisdiction, complete jurisdiction.
Well, I mean, here's just a few examples. Page 1679 of the Congressional Record, President Johnson vetoes the first version of the Civil Rights Act, and he says, I can't sign this because it would extend citizenship to the children of, quote, all domiciled aliens and foreigners, even if not naturalized. And you have all the other sources we cited that say, this is a deeply rooted 19th century understanding. It's reflected in the Venus. It's reflected in the Pizarro in 1814 and 1817. It carries through the 19th century, and this court is talking about it in 1892 and 1893 when it's discussing the Chinese Exclusion Acts. Domicile is the key concept that creates allegiance. That's
General, you said
in your reply brief that the children of slaves who were brought here
unlawfully. That's Justice Amy Coney Barrett.
In defiance of laws forbidding the slave trade. Would in fact be citizens. And
yes,
we can imagine that their parents were not only brought here in violation of United States law, but were here against their will, and so maybe felt allegiance to the countries where they were from. And you say that the purpose of the 14th Amendment was to put all slaves on equal footing, newly freed slaves on equal footing, and so they would be citizens. But that's not textual. So how do you get there? You say it in just a few sentences, so can you elaborate?
Sure. If you look at the 19th century sources, what you see is that even though their entry may have been unlawful, 19th century antebellum law never treated their presence as unlawful. In fact, quite the opposite. One of the amici, in fact, points to like a Mississippi statute, which probably is replicated throughout the South before the Civil War, that says slaves in Mississippi have an indefeasible domicile in Mississippi. In other words, even if they run away, if they get away, Mississippi says, nope, you still live here, right? And so it would be astonishing, in other words, for the opponents of the 14th Amendment to say, you know, these people were not domiciled and therefore it goes the other way, because actually U.S. law, even if they were brought in illegally and through an illegal slave trade, once they were there, by
well,
US
their
law,
intent is to return as soon as they can, let's say. So they're here, they're resident, and maybe under your theory, I mean, which says, well, lawfulness for a different purpose, but they're here, they're resident, let's take your assumption that they're not here unlawfully. But let's say they don't have an intent to stay. They want to escape and go back the second they can. Are they domiciled?
under the 19th century law, I mean, I think this is the flip side of the hypothetical that we were talking about earlier. Under 19th century law, they are treated as domiciled in the United States, so it would be astonishing. And in the debates in the congressional floor talk about not this specific case, but they say, look, slaves who have been forced to come here and have been here are lawfully domiciled here. I mean, they don't use the ways domiciled, but like they have, they use allegiance. They say they don't have allegiance to, once they've been forced to come here, they don't have allegiance to any foreign or African potentate, and therefore they're...
But General, that goes
how would that apply to human, the children of illegally trafficked people today? Would the same reasoning apply?
It would turn on whether the parents are lawfully domiciled in the United States.
So if they're brought in illegally, but then they choose to remain and they want to remain and they're domiciled, you would say that their lawful presence is not dictated by whether they were brought here lawfully or not. And that's different from someone who, say, crosses the border unlawfully.
Yeah, I think it would turn on whether their presence is lawful.
General,
in other words, obviously there may be many other important things that could be done to assist people like that. The question is, if they give birth to someone in the United States, that person naturally a citizen, that would turn, based on the original public meaning of the clause, on the lawfulness of their presence. Are they domiciled?
General, can I ask you a question? To follow up on what Justice Gorsuch was exploring with you.
That's
with
Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson.
I understand you to say that domicile is going to be eventually or is controlled by Congress. Who is domiciled? I'm struggling to figure out who is domiciled in your argument.
The domiciliaries are people who are lawfully present and have an intent to remain permanently. So that's a kind of black letter, you know, understanding of domicile. Now, Congress can dictate that certain classes of people, legal entrants and so forth, cannot lawfully, lack the legal capacity to form a legally binding domicile.
But if that's so, then doesn't it make the domicile for the purpose of the 14th Amendment turn then ultimately on Congress's will in a way that the framers did not intend? I mean, my understanding was the framers put this citizenship clause into the Constitution to prevent future Congresses from being able to affect citizenship in this way.
Sure.
Very briefly, no, I don't think so, because it is up to the alien whether or not they want to be domiciled here. Now, there may be collateral
consequences. But I thought you just said Congress can make determinations as to who counts as being domiciled here. Yeah, so if that's true, then it ultimately would impact, in your theory, whether or not this person can claim that they have citizenship for 14th Amendment purposes based on Congress's determination. And I just thought that's what the 14th Amendment was trying to get away from.
Yes, please.
Very briefly, I just point you to the discussion in Professor Worman's amicus brief where he talks about this is not a new problem. Going back even to the British common law, there's a situation of people who lack a safe conduct and are passing through the king's domains without permission. And he says the best reading of the common law is they are not under the protection of the king and they're not covered by the rule of birthright citizenship.
Thank you, counsel. You mentioned in your briefing and also this morning the problem of birth tourism.
That's Chief Justice John Roberts talking.
Information about how common that is or how significant a problem it is?
It's a great question. No one knows for sure. There's a March 9th letter from a number of members of Congress to DHS saying, do we have any information about this? The media reports indicate estimates could be over a million or 1.5 million from the People's Republic of China alone. The congressional report that we cite in our brief talks about certain hotspots like Russian elites coming to Miami through these birth tourism companies. And I mean, here's a fact about it that I think is striking. Media reported as early as 2015 that based on Chinese media reports, there are 500 birth tourism companies in the People's Republic of China whose business is to bring people here to give birth and return to that nation.
Having said all that, you do agree that that has no impact on the legal analysis before us?
I think it's, I'd quote what Justice Scalia said in his Hamdan dissent, where they have, where it, like their interpretation has these implications that could not possibly have been approved by the 19th century framers of this amendment. I think that shows that they made a mess, their interpretation has made a mess of the provision.
Well, it certainly wasn't a problem in the 19th century.
No, but of course, we're in a new world now, as Justice Alito pointed out, to where 8 billion people are one plane ride away from having a child who's a U.S. citizen.
Well, it's a new world. It's the same Constitution.
It is, and as Justice Scalia said, I think in the case that Justice Alito was referring to, you've got a constitutional provision that addresses certain evils, and it should be extended to reasonably comparable evils. He said that about statutory interpretation. I think the same principle applies here, and I think we quote that in our brief.
Thank you. Justice Thomas, anything further?
Generally, you're getting a lot of questions about immigration, and they harken back, of course, to the citizenship, which is defined in or set out in the 14th Amendment. How much of the debates around the 14th Amendment had anything to do with immigration?
I think that the principal focus of those debates, it has to do really not with immigrants, but with the Indian tribes. I mean, obviously the main goal, the one pervading purpose, as this court said in the Slaughterhouse cases, was to establish the citizenship of the freed slaves and their children. But they were very concerned about the problem of something that they all accepted as a given, which is that the children of tribal Indians are not within the rule of birthright citizenship. So I think that's what they focus on. We draw an analogy to that, to the issue of temporary sojourners. And then, but there are mentions of temporary sojourning multiple places in the congressional debates, and all of those quotes go in our direction.
And there was, Justice Sotomayor brought up Wong King Ark. There was no question in that case that about domicile, was there?
I disagree. The court says at the very beginning of its opinion, here are the accepted facts. These are lawfully domiciled here. When it states the question presented, it talks about domicile. When it recites the legal principle at page 693, it says domicile three times. And at page 705, at the end of the opinion, it says here's the single question we've decided. We've decided that Chinese immigrants with a permanent domicile and residence here are fall within the rule of birthright citizenship.
Justice Alito?
Under the minimum definition of domicile, which I think existed in 1868 and continues to exist today, a person's domicile is the place where he or she intends to make a permanent home. Now, normally, you would think that a person who is subject to arrest at any time and removal could not establish a domicile. But we have an unusual situation here because our immigration laws have been ineffectively and in some instances unenthusiastically enforced by federal officials. So there are people who are subject to removal at any time if they are apprehended and they go through the proper procedures. But they have, in their minds, made a permanent home here and have established roots. And that raises a humanitarian problem. And I wonder if you could address that.
If I may, one legal and one humanitarian. The legal point is, if you look at those cases, for example, Carson against Reed, Park against Barr, this court's decisions in Elkins and Toll against Marino, they talk about the legal capacity to create a domicile, excluding someone who may have the subjective intent, which otherwise would be determinative, as being excluded. On the humanitarian point, I would point out, as I said at the beginning, Justice Alito, that the United States rule of nearly unrestricted birthright citizenship is an outlier among modern nations. It's a very small minority of nations that have that rule. For example, every nation in Europe has a different rule, and the notion that they have a huge humanitarian crisis as a result of not having unrestricted birthright citizenship, I don't think is a strong argument. And I point out, obviously, for reliance-related reasons, this executive order applies only prospectively, and we ask the court to rule only prospectively.
Justice Sotomayor?
I agree with you what the European nation's rule is, but England was always different, wasn't it?
Not until 1983 it changed.
That's not quite true. The Wong Kim Ark does a wonderful job of laying out the English rule. And you claim it was different, but there isn't any treatises or scholars who say it's different. English rule was always by birth. Other countries were not by birth. Let me just go to the implications of what you're asking us to do. You are asking us to overrule Wong Kim Ark? Well, there, Wong Kim Ark's parents were domiciled in the U.S., but they owed loyalty to China. They eventually returned to China. So they didn't have a primary allegiance to the United States. So you're not asking that. Are you asking us to overrule, then, our cases, one of which said that a child of illegal aliens was a citizen? You're asking us to overrule that.
No, first of all, we're not asking you over to overrule Wong Kim Ark. We agree with the holding of Wong Kim Ark and much of the reasoning. And then as to those later cases starting in 1966, where the court makes sort of, you know, unreasoned references to this issue.
Wait a minute. Him top you loose. The respondent unlawfully overstayed her visa and gave birth to a child here. The court, Harlan II, wrote, the child is, of course, an American citizen. That person wasn't domiciled here lawfully. So you're asking us to overrule that case?
I wouldn't say we're asking you to overrule. We think that's similar to a drive-by jurisdictional ruling where there's a simple statement that's not debated. There's no further analysis of it. There's really an assumption there. And we think that's similar to cases where the court just assumes jurisdiction without discussing
it. When we ruled in Trind that Indians could not become citizens, the government then after began to unnaturalize many Indians who had been sworn in as citizens. You asked us to concentrate only on the prospective nature of the citizen's order. But the logic of your position, if accepted, is that this president or the next president or a Congress or someone else could decide that it shouldn't be prospective. There would be nothing limiting that, according to your theory.
If, as we asked, the court confines its ruling to prospective relief only, which it did in session.
No, I'm saying to you, that's what you're asking us for relief right now. I'm asking whether the logic of your theory would permit what happened after the court's decision in Trin, that the government could move to unnaturalize people who were born here of illegal residents.
No, we believe the court should do what it did in Sessions against Morales-Santana, where there was a ruling that would have deprived people who are already citizens of citizenship, and the court said this applies prospectively only, and we think that's the appropriate course here.
But that's not what we did in Trin.
We think that Sessions provides the proper course here, and that's what we're asking. We are not asking for any retroactive relief.
Justice Kagan?
General, I think even your brief concedes that the position you're taking now is a revisionist one with respect to a substantial part of our history. And I think that that's in large part because of Wong Kim Ark and the way people have read that case, which of course was in the late 19th century, and have read it ever since then. And what that case suggests is, I mean, there's a very clear rationale. You say, it says the word domicile a bunch of times, which it does. It's a long opinion. It says a lot of things. But the rationale of the case is really quite clear. It says there was this common law tradition. It came from England. We know what it was. Everybody got citizenship by birth, except for a few discrete categories, which were the ones that the Chief Justice mentioned at the beginning. And that tradition carried over to the United States. And then what the 14th Amendment did was accept that tradition and not attempt to place any limitations on it. And so that was the clear rationale, a clear rationale that is diametrically different from your rationale. And everybody took Wong Kim Ark to say that and to say that as a result of that, of course, birthright citizenship was the rule, and I think everybody has believed that for a long, long time. And I guess my question is this. You have a story about the reasons why we should go back to what you view as the original meaning. And given the long history of this country's understanding about birthright citizenship, what would it take, what do you think it should take to accept that story? In terms of the magnitude of the evidence that we would need to see in order to accept this revisionist theory and in order to change what I think people have thought the rule was for more than a century.
Let me make 2 points in response to that, one historical and one legal. Historical point, I disagree with the way you've characterized the understanding of Wong Kim Ark, and I would point to something that's emphasized in their amici's briefs, which is in 1921, Richard Flournoy, who becomes a senior State Department official in the Roosevelt administration and pushes their theory as to temporary sojourners, writes a law review article in 1921 where he says, I think the children of temporary visitors should be citizens. But he admits that is not the understanding of Wong Kim Ark. He admits Wong Kim Ark did not hold that. And he admits that there's an array of authorities that go against him. He talks about careful and reliable, high authorities. And that's referring to the consensus that we point out in pages 26, 28 of our brief. We've got 12 treatises from 1881 to 1922 that all say, including for decades after Wong Kim Ark, that say children of temporary sojourners are not included. What happens between 1921 and the 1930s? Well, Mr. Flournoy became a senior State Department official, and he adopted that as the policy of the Roosevelt administration. So their argument is basically saying there wasn't this consensus going back to 1898. The consensus, as their own author admits, goes entirely in the opposite direction. For 50 years, right, for 50 years from the framing of the clause through the 1920s, maybe 60 years, the general understanding when it comes to what's at issue here and was not at issue in Wong Kim Ark is the children of temporary visitors do not become citizens under the clause. And then the legal point, you referred to this sort of concept of temporary local allegiance, and they rely on the Schooner Exchange, this theory that you've got temporary local allegiance. But if you actually look at page 572 of the congressional record, right at the beginning, introducing the Civil Rights Act, Senator Trumbull says, I said not subject to any foreign power. I wanted to say born in the United States and, you know, owing allegiance to the United States, but I was aware that there's a, quote, a sort of allegiance from persons temporarily resident in the United States whom we have no right to make citizens. So Senator Trumbull says, the reason I haven't adopted the language and meaning that they say should be packed into these provisions is that everybody knows that the children of temporary visitors should not be citizens.
Thank you, General.
Justice Gorsuch?
Just to follow up on that point, General, one interesting counterpoint about the understanding of Wong Kim Ark that followed with respect to temporary sojourners. And I take you've got your well-taken points. But there was, of course, John Marshall Harlan, the great dissenter who dissented in Wong Kim Ark and later gave a bunch of lectures. And he posed the question about the sojourners. Suppose an English father and mother went down to the hot springs to get rid of the gout. And while there, they have a child. Now back in England. Is that child a citizen of the United States, born of the jurisdiction thereof by mere accident of birth? And he says, under Wong Kim Ark, he is. And he continues, I was one of the minority, and of course I was wrong. Now, I'm sure that was tongue-in-cheek, but now, what do you do with that?
I'd say two things in response to that. First of all, he gave a speech, but we have 12 uncontradicted treatises that say the opposite, that is not what Wong Kim Ark means, and that's not the meaning of the clause. But also, I'd make a more fundamental point. When you're looking at Wong Kim Ark, one of the dissent has this dominant theme that really Tom theme like you can't be doing this because you can't make the we all agree or it's obvious that the children of temporary visitors do not become citizens. And how does the majority opinion address that? It says domicile three times when it recites the legal rule. It says permanent residence and domicile when it decides the holding. So the court should be bound by what it says. This is what we're deciding. And again, on page 75, it says, this is the single question. Now, there's been a lot of discussion up to that point. But at the very end, they said the single question we've decided is the citizenship status of the children of Chinese immigrants with a permanent residence and domicile in the United States.
Do you think Native Americans today are birthright citizens under your test and under your friend's test?
I think so. I mean, obviously, they've been granted citizenship by statute.
Put aside the statute. Yeah. You think they're birthright citizens?
No, I think the clear understanding that everybody agrees in the congressional debates is that the children of tribal Indians are not birthright citizens.
I understand that's what they said, but your test is the domicile of the parents, and that would be the test you'd have us apply today, right?
Yes, yes. So and if a tribal Indian, for example, gives up allegiance to...
Born today... birthright citizens?
I think so, on our test. Yeah. Okay. If they're lawfully domiciled here.
Okay.
I have to think that through, but that's my reaction.
I'll take the yes. That's all right. and then I just want to ask you quickly about the INA, adopted in 1940 and 1952. It uses the same term as the citizenship clause. And one might have a pretty good argument. I'm sure you got some arguments along just these lines that it should be understood to mean whatever it meant in 1868. But there was a lot of water over the dam between those two things. And as your brief points out, by the Roosevelt administration, there's a pretty strong jus soli move. That is to say that the thin concept of jurisdiction, power over, is enough, a broader understanding of birthright. Would there be an argument for reading that statute under its original plain meaning at the time, 1940, 1952, to perhaps have a different meaning than the Constitution?
We don't think that's the best interpretation. Give two reasons. One is it would be very surprising if a statute that says exactly the constitutional phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, were interpreted to mean something totally different or to ossify a then-current misunderstanding of the clause. We think that the best analogy here is probably state long-arm statutes. Take a sort of non-controversial example. State long-arm statutes routinely say we're going to exercise personal jurisdiction to the extent of due process. It takes the constitutional standard and it puts it in the statute, and nobody thinks that those ossify, you know, are limited to the precedent, this court's precedence at the time they're enacted. Everyone thinks that that phrase, due process, incorporates, the developing law of due process and minimum context and so forth, including from this court. So we think that's the best analogy. When you're looking at the constitutional phrase itself and you take it out of a freighted context, the natural interpretation is to say this reflects the objective meaning of the Constitution. And the objective meaning of the Constitution is its original public meaning in 1866 and 1868.
Do you see any notable counterpoints to that argument?
I'm sure there are arguments on the other side. We address them in their brief.
You're really, at the end of the day, then, this is a straight-up constitutional ruling you want from this court, win, lose, or draw?
Yeah, we think that the statute and the Constitution means the same thing. If the court disagrees, obviously we prefer an adverse ruling. If the court's going to do that on a statutory basis than a constitutional basis.
But you just disavowed that in your responses to me by saying that that's not an available option is the way I understood it.
Yes, the court would have to disagree with our statutory position, which is that it means the same thing as the Constitution. But if the court were to do that, then the natural course would probably be to rule on statutory grounds alone. Now, we think they mean the same thing, and we've got arguments for that, including, I think, the analogy I just referenced.
Thank you.
Justice Kavanaugh?
General, how should we think about the text of the 14th Amendment, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, as distinct from the different language of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which refers, as you know, to persons not subject to any foreign power? Those texts are, on their face, different. And the history that Justice Kagan referred to might have developed quite a bit differently if the 14th Amendment's text had used the phrase that was in the Civil Rights Act.
That's an excellent point. And this court has held in multiple cases, Heard against Hodge and General Building Contractors, has recognized that they are intended and they did mean the same thing. And that's powerfully reinforced by the congressional debates where you really what they're discussing is they said they were dissatisfied with the language in the Civil Rights Act because the phrase Indians not taxed they thought was ambiguous. And so they switched to the affirmative statement as opposed to the negative statement. The affirmative statement is subject to the jurisdiction thereof, but there's express statements in the congressional record essentially that we're doing the same thing. And that is what this court's case law has reflected.
Why didn't they say the same thing?
Again, it appears they preferred the sort of positive formulation subject to the jurisdiction thereof as opposed to not subject to any foreign power. And again, there's a deep concern and lengthy discussion of the potential ambiguity in the Civil Rights Act thing. They want to eliminate an ambiguity but do the same thing. And I think that that's very strongly reflected in those debates.
By the time of the 1940 and 1952 congressional actions, where Congress repeats subject to the jurisdiction thereof, given Juan Kim Arc, one might have expected Congress to use a different phrase if it wanted to try to disagree with Juan Kim Arc on what the scope of birthright citizenship or the scope of citizenship should be. And yet Congress repeats that same language knowing what the interpretation had been. So how are we to think about that?
I think baked into that question is an understanding, I think that was reflected in Justice Kagan's earlier question, that everybody understood that Juan Kim Arc meant that. And the history I talked about, I think, refutes that. That really there's a consensus that goes our way for decades and decades after the adoption of the amendment and after Juan Kim Arc on the specific question of the children of temporary visitors. And it's really not until, and again, in their author in 1921 is saying, hey, the other side is the consensus.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
But there's executive branch interpretations and others. And if you're in Congress in 1940 and 1952 and you want to limit the scope of Wong Kim Ark or to eliminate ambiguity, why do you repeat the same language rather than choosing something different? For example, you could use the language from the Civil Rights Act of 1866 or some similar formulation if your idea in 1940 and 1952 was to not have ambiguity or not have an overly broad scope.
I think if you look at the structure of that statute where it's 1401A and then B through H, A, and it says these are the people who are entitled to birthright citizenship. A is the constitutional standard, and then B through H are all the categories that Congress has superadded to that. I think the natural inference is that Congress is codifying, which it was consciously doing in 1941, pulling all the naturalization rules and immigration rules together into one statute and said, you go to one place, here's who is a birthright citizen. A, those who are guaranteed that right by the citizenship clause, and B through H are the ones that Congress has added through its naturalization power. So that inference to me says A is merely, it's not trying to change or alter the constitutional standard, just saying, hey, the baseline is what the Constitution says, and we codify that, and then we move on to the new categories.
Of what relevance, if any, do you think Section 5 of the 14th Amendment has here that gives Congress the power to enforce the article, the 14th Amendment, by appropriate legislation? Does that give Congress room here, or do you not think so?
I do think that a ruling in our favor would leave room for Congress. I don't think you'd have to rely on Section 5. I think that Congress has its own inherent power to grant citizenship by statute. So if the court were to rule in our favor for the classes of individuals that they say should be covered, Congress has the latitude to do that.
How much room do you think Section 5 gives, if any, and it may not be any, Congress to interpret the phrase subject to the jurisdiction thereof or to define that? Is that relevant at all?
It's a great question, and I'm thinking about it for the first time. I assume it would be governed by the congruence and proportionality test from this court's case law. How that would apply here, I don't know. And I don't think it's presented, because our contention is that the statute means exactly the same thing. If anything is congruent and proportional, it's that. And I think the court held that in the United States against Georgia.
You've mentioned several times the practices of other countries. And that's obviously, as a policy matter, supports what you're arguing here, but obviously we try to interpret American law with American precedent based on American history. That's certainly what I try to do, and I think you try to do. And so why should we be thinking about, even though as a policy matter I get the point, thinking about, gee, European countries don't have this, or most other countries, many other countries in the world don't have this, doesn't that? I guess I'm not seeing the relevance as a legal, constitutional, interpretive matter necessarily, although I understand it's a very good point as a policy matter.
Yeah, I largely agree with that, and you can view it as being raised preemptively, defensively. I'm going first, but obviously the other side in their amici say, you know, make it a prediction, end of the world type predictions, and our point is, you know, it's a very small minority of countries. Almost every country, and certainly all European countries, have a different rule, and the world hasn't ended there.
The other side, last one, the other side relies heavily, of course, on Wong Kim Ark, and you disagree with their interpretation. Oftentimes, when you are dealing with a constitutional precedent like this, you might argue, we disagree with that interpretation, but if you adopt their interpretation or agree with their interpretation of that precedent, you should overrule it. And you haven't made that argument here, and I'm just giving you an opportunity to explain why you haven't.
Because we think it's totally unambiguous in Wong Kim Ark that the holding relates to domiciled aliens. And so we strongly agree with the holding. We think domicile was the touchstone, and we think that's not a coincidence for the reason I maybe speculated a little bit when I was talking to Justice Gorsuch about you know, how the dissent raises this, and then the majority's like, well, we're putting domicile in there, so we know that the absurd conclusion that they say would come from this isn't there. But also, domicile as kind of the sort of relationship that creates this relationship of allegiance that makes you part of a political community if you're an alien from another country, that's deeply rooted in their understanding when they're doing it. They talk about domicile in Yickwo against Hopkins in the 1892 and 1893 cases, and there's this deeply rooted understanding, again, that goes all the way back to the early 19th century. So we think that's a really important conception. So I mean, we disagree with some of the dicta in Wong Kim Ark that we discuss, and we think there's dicta that goes our way that the other side overlooks. And we're not asking the court to overrule dicta. We just say don't follow erroneous dicta and don't apply it to this brand new situation that was not decided in Wong Kim Ark.
Thank you.
Justice Barrett?
So General Sarah, I want to zoom out a little bit and think about jus soli and jus sanguinis. So as I understand it, at the time of the 14th Amendment, those were the two dominant approaches. You know, jus soli, the English common law, roughly following the soil. Jus sanguinis, roughly citizenship following the parents. Now, jus soli was very generous on the soil, the English common law, and so it extended citizenship to those born there who may not have been born of parent citizens. But jus sanguinis, you know, if parents who were citizens and had a child abroad, then that child's citizenship followed the parents. So one thing that's puzzling me about your argument when I think about the ratification of the 14th Amendment, in many ways it would have made sense for them, and you acknowledge the jus sanguinis in citing Vattel, it would have made sense in some ways for them to say,